field of language development, some evidence from the US. My goal for today is that you leave this talk believing that there's no such thing as quote unquote quality linguistic input. And to suggest so is linguistic racism. So hopefully that's what you walk away from this talk with today. So first, I'm going to start with some truths about language development. And the biggest thing about language development that you may not know is that we don't actually know as much about language development as we think we do. So what do I mean by that? Kidd and Garcia did this analysis of four major academic journals of child language development back in 2022, so not too long ago. And they did it from inception to 2020, which is around 45 years of journal content. And the 45% of the studies were on English. So more than half of all the studies that we have on child language development are on English. And 30% more of that, so 84% were on languages from the Indo-European family. So 84%, that is a big percentage of what we know about child language development. And that's all from one language family. And so why is this a problem? Well, studies on the diversity of languages and language varieties inform theories of language development and the nature of linguistic environments of children. So if we don't have a big sample pool, we're not really getting all the information that we could possibly have. So for example, in speech directed to children in Samoan, Kaluli, and Kichi, these studies falsified assumptions that we had about grammatical and prosodic modifications assumed to be universal because they were observed in English, German, and French, again, from the Indo-European family. But unfortunately, studies like this that aren't on languages from the Indo-European family are exceptions to the rule. And even more egregious, in my opinion, is that 87% of the papers that they analyzed from four major academic journals had authors from either North America or Europe, and mostly in Northern and Western Europe. So why do I think that this is egregious? Well, and why does it matter that the field is so homogenous? So we don't know as much as we think we know because interpretations of studies are overwhelmingly coming from the perspective of white people of Western European descent. And so this is a very limited viewpoint. And so what we're getting, the information that we're getting is through this lens. And generalizations about language development from monolingual English-speaking white families of Western European descent are taken then for granted as quote unquote normal because members of the white middle and upper classes are disproportionately writing these articles and consuming them. So whiteness becomes the default and anything else becomes marked. So in the state of the field, the interpretations that I've encountered in the literature of the 87% of, people from North America or Western or Northern Europe rely heavily on this rhetoric of quality and that quality linguistic input is necessary for successful language development. And unfortunately, this relies on a deficit perspective of a subset of children and their families, specifically racialized children and their families, which we'll get back to. But let's talk more about why it's a problem and why it's a problem that quality linguistic input is said to be necessary for successful language development, and why it doesn't follow from what we know to be true of language development. So one of the major truths about language development is that children learn the language of their linguistic environment, spoken or signed, without direct teaching. So the idea that they would need quality linguistic input to further their language development is fallacious. So here's examples of why of children learning without direct teaching. So you may have seen these examples before if you've ever taken a language development class, but they're worth sharing again. So child, my teacher holded the baby rabbit and we patted them. Adult, did you say that your teacher held the baby rabbit? Yes. What did you say she did? She holded the baby rabbit and we patted them. Did you say she held them tightly? No, she holded them loosely. So you see, the adult is trying to intervene and get the child to say held, but the child keeps saying holded because that's where they are in their development. Another example here, child, want other one spoon, daddy. Adult, you mean you want the other spoon? Child, yes, I want other one spoon, please, daddy. Can you say the other spoon? Other one spoon. Say other, other, spoon, spoon. Adult, other spoon. Child, other spoon. Now give me other one spoon. So here we have an even more direct intervention on the child and trying to get the child to say it a certain way. And the child is able to say other and spoon, but they're still going back to their current level, which is at saying other one spoon. And one more. So the child, nobody don't like me. Mother, no, say nobody likes me. Child, nobody don't like me. And this repeats 8 times. And the mother says, now listen carefully, say nobody likes me. And the child, oh, nobody don't likes me. So here again, we're saying, we've seen the kid think that they know what the mother wants, but doesn't actually give what the mother wants. And I'm also really, every time I see this, I'm like, why is the mother concerned about the child's grammar when this poor child is saying that nobody likes them? So that always gets me, but anyway. Okay, so like I said, going back to truths about language development, children are gonna learn the language environment, again, spoken or signed, without direct teaching. And Shirley Bryce Heath did an ethnography of two different, very different language communities. And she said this, which I think wraps it up very succinctly, this first point. So in each community, by the time they go to school, the children know the sounds, words, and grammatical systems of the language spoken around them. They have learned their community's ways of using language to get along with people and to accomplish their social goals. They have learned to use language to acquire the knowledge their community has judged they should know at their age, and they have learned appropriate ways of expressing that knowledge. So that's what happens by the time the children are 5 and go to school. And that's something that we do know about language development. Okay, the second truth about language development that's important for today is that all language varieties, spoken and signed, written or not, are linguistically equal. Okay. So I really like this quote from Dr. Keith Cross in Talking Black in America about this. So what does standard English accomplish that these so-called versions of substandard English do not accomplish in terms of communication? Nothing, you know what I mean? Nothing at all. And anything that seems to stand in the way, you say, oh, it'll help you get a job. Well, is that because of the language? It's not that you are unable to communicate. Or is it that because of all of these various isms that stand in the way of you being able to take care of yourself? So, yes. It's, and whether you speak quote unquote standard mainstream English, US English, whether you speak Finnish English, whether you speak Chicano English, whether you speak African American English, all of these varieties are linguistically equal. And they all accomplish the same task of communication. But a problem that we run into in the child development literature is that there are authors or researchers that say that that children are unable, things that go against these two truths. So one of them is from Hoff 2003, who claims that children from middle-class families receive linguistic input that has more of the characteristics that are positively associated with language development. We have Romeo 2019, who claims that access to a rich early language environment promotes children's language development. Rowe et al. 2017 claim that not all input is created equal. And there are many others that say that some input is quality and other input is impoverished. So if these two truths about language development are true, and given what we know about language development, they seem to be true, how can some linguistic input then be more positively associated with language development? And if these things are true, how can some linguistic input be quality? So this is about more than language. So let's talk about what is quality linguistic input. Quality linguistic input does not exist. That's what I hope you walk away from this talk remembering. But let's see what the literature says about quality linguistic input. So in the literature, selectively frames some linguistic input as quality or more positively associated with language development. And this is only possible if we misrepresent what language development is, because like I said, the first truth about language development is that children will learn the language around them without direct teaching. And that the second one is that all language varieties are equal. So how can some be quality if all are equal? And how can some be more positively associated with language development if all children learn the language around them? So it relies on the fallacy that language development does not proceed correctly within some within certain children based on what their caregivers provide for them. So in other words, some caregivers allegedly have subpar linguistic skills. This is deficit thinking, and it is also racist. And so I want to tell you about why it is racist. So the contemporary origins of the idea of quality linguistic input comes from Hart and Reasley, as early as 1995, and their monograph, Meaningful Differences in the Everyday Experience of Young American Children. And so this is the word gap study, if you've heard of that. So you may have not have heard about the background of the word gap study, and I'm going to tell you right now about it. So Hart and Reasley were the first study, this is the first study to document language experience of children across socioeconomic status. It's a longitudinal study over 2.5 years. And it was conducted with 42 families in Kansas City, Kansas, the U.S. And it starts when children are about 7 to 9 months old to 3 years old, which is actually very impressive. If anyone's ever tried to do a longitudinal study, you know, it's very difficult. So, you know, they were able to capture some good data here over time. So that I'll give them that. And they do have the data that they collected were sequential monthly 1 hour recordings from the children and their caregivers. And what they did is they calculated the mean number of words spoken to children, among other things. And so I want to point out how important it is here that how the socioeconomic status is measured in this case with maternal education, how it breaks down, because the 42 families were separated by SES. And here you can see that 13 were in the upper class, 10 were in middle class, 13 were in lower, and 6 were in the so-called welfare class. But if we look at Black families, we see that in the welfare class, 6 out of 6 of the families were Black families, and only 1 of the upper class families was Black. And so why is this important? Well, based on this linguistic input gathered during these 1 hour sessions, what Hart and Reasley are doing are they are concluding that the Black families in the so-called welfare category will hear 30 million fewer words than the professional families by the time they are 4 years old. So the word gap is a 30 million word gap is the claim. And all of this, all of it is extrapolated from 6 Black families in Kansas City in the late 1980s. So as you can see here on the y-axis, it says estimated cumulative words with words addressed to child. So this is all extrapolated data. This is not observed data. And just like that, we get one of the most racist conclusions in psycholinguistic history, in my opinion. And sorry, here we go. And so why is this racist? Hart and Reasley are what I call race evaders. They circumvent conversations about race by claiming that they are only looking at socioeconomic status. However, poverty is extremely racialized in the U.S. We have a racialized caste system here. And as you saw earlier, all of Hart and Reasley's welfare families were Black and only 1 professional family was Black. So poverty then becomes shorthand for all the consequences of racism and racialization processes and institutionalized racism. And Hart and Reasley fail to acknowledge this. In fact, they say that it's not about race at all. So this very, what I consider very racist conclusion is proliferated and it gets into the mainstream. So Hillary Clinton, at the launch of Too Small to Fail, which is her nonprofit, says, "We want to help close the word gap in America by reminding everyone from pediatricians to parents to grandparents to spread the message on how they can make talking, reading, and seeing everyday activities." Even President Obama said, "We know that right now, during the first 3 years of life, a child born into a low-income family hears 30 million fewer words than a child born into a well-off family." And Hillary Clinton's Too Small to Fail campaign actually partnered with several TV shows like Law and Order and Orange is the New Black. And in Orange is the New Black, the way that they partnered with them is that they got one of the inmates to say this to the caregiver of their child. There's all these studies that say that if you don't talk to the baby, they end up like effed by the time they're five, which is a direct reference to the Hart and Reasley study. So quality linguistic input, as I said, does not exist. Hart and Reasley were actually concerned with both the quantity and quality of the linguistic input. So they claimed that there was 30 million fewer words that welfare families would hear, or welfare families would direct to their children. They are also concerned with something called quality linguistic input. And the quality linguistic input, the word gap relies specifically on the fallacy that quality linguistic input is necessary for successful language development. But as I've said, successful language development proceeds in children without direct teaching. So there is no need, again, to be concerned about how many words are directed to the children and the quality of the linguistic input that is directed to the children. So let's talk a little bit about what quality linguistic input is in the literature. Oh, and also say that, let's see. Yeah. And the idea that the word gap does exist between rich children and poor children, and actually what they're saying is between white children and racialized children, it relies on the fallacy that racialized children poor children that are overwhelmingly racialized do not receive quality linguistic input. And so what is this quality linguistic input that I keep talking about? So quality is defined sort of by Hart and Reasley and others in the field as kind of the words and phrases and sentence constructions, the words and what sentence constructions they entail. So something like, and all the discursive styles as well. So conversational turn taking is one marker of quality linguistic input, according to people that buy into the idea of quality linguistic input. So even if a child is not able to speak, you might have a parent who does conversational turn taking with a baby, like, "Oh, look at, we're changing your diaper. You see that we're changing your diaper?" And then the parent waits for like a cooing or some sort of turn by the child, and they say, "Oh yes, we're changing your diaper." See, I even have trouble imitating this because I don't, you know, do this with children. A lot of people don't do this with children. This is something that's very cultural. So that's one example. Lexical diversity. So the diversity of the words that the child is exposed to, quote unquote, rare words. Decontextualized language, so talking about things that aren't present at the moment. Child-directed speech or parentese. So again, just this, "Oh, look at you, you're so cute." So changing your intonation and your prosodic and having prosodic modifications. Again, something that's really difficult for me because I don't have this I didn't grow up with this either. My dad doesn't do it, my mom does do it. Again, even within one family, you may have people doing these things and not doing these things. Open-ended questions, like, "What did you do with your day?" WH questions, structural complexity. So having sentences that have relative clauses, affirmations, being positive with a child, for some reason that is considered quality linguistic input. Use of iconic gestures, like seeing the itsy bitsy spider and using your hands to imitate the spider. And also referential language, like showing a child a ball and saying, this is a ball. And okay. Some of the things that they say are impoverished or not quality linguistic input are prohibitions, telling the kids not to do something, directives, telling children to do something. I've also seen it described as unresponsive, taciturn parenting style, and also non-native speech. So all of these ideas of quality linguistic input are, as we talked about from the beginning, are coming from a certain lens. And so there, it's very homogenous, the people that are talking about this. And in fact, worldwide, the word gap and quality linguistic input claim is constructed on language data from those who are from Western educated, industrial, rich, democratic, or so-called weird families. And I also want to say, too, that it's not just weird, because we, you know, in the United States, we have all sorts of different race and ethnicities, but it's white families that are the majority of the data that we see in language development studies. And so what this sampling bias does is that it normalizes the language of those with social power. In the case of the US, that's the white middle and upper classes. And it pathologizes other varieties. So this manifests as deficit models, as I've said, of racialized children's language in the literature and beyond. And beyond because it's made its way into the mainstream, like I said. Even in the United States State of the Union this past, like last month, President Joe Biden actually mentioned the word gap. So what does it mean when we pathologize all other varieties? This results in unnecessary intervention into the language and lives of racialized children and families. And so I wanted to show you an example of what that looks like in the literature, what they say needs to happen to the families and the children of whom it is said that they do not get quality linguistic input. So here we go. So many parent coaching models already emphasize increasing the quantity of child-directed speech, but perhaps even more important is the quality or content of verbal interactions. Beyond educating parents about the importance of turn-taking, clinicians may need to model optimal turn-taking behaviors. This includes teaching children or teaching parents about maximizing opportunities for conversation, following the child's lead and waiting for a response, establishing joint attention to a referent or topic, continuing conversation through questions and other cues, and in some cases, educating parents of both verbal and nonverbal forms of a child's turn. So here we are, Romeo 2019 is talking about intervening into the lives of these families to educate parents about the importance of quality linguistic input, of so-called quality linguistic input. And this is, you know, very patronizing. This is, you know, invading their lives to change the way that they speak to their children because of the idea that they aren't getting enough words or enough quality linguistic input. And so this is where I want to bring in linguistic racism, which is the denial of fundamental human rights in institutional and non-institutional settings based on language use. And this subset of racism reproduces, regulates, and legitimizes unequal division of power and resources, both material and immaterial. And it favors linguistic behaviors associated with white people, promoting white linguistic hegemony and white supremacy. So what we're doing here is if we're saying that we need to intervene into the lives of these people, is that we're denying them their right to their own language, which is part of the UN's Declaration of Human Rights. So we are denying them a fundamental human right. And it also, we keep perpetuating the idea that there are certain linguistic behaviors, specifically those associated with white people, that are better. And one of the most egregious examples I've seen of how linguistic racism shows up because of the word gap was in a paper from 2017 from Adair and colleagues. And they found that teachers were giving Latinx students less agentic, self-directed work. And they cited the word gap as the reason. So they said that the parents of these children were not talking to them enough and that the children didn't have good enough vocabulary to work, to do this agentic self-directed work. And they specifically cited the word gap. So this also plays into what Flores and Rosa call raciolinguistic ideologies, which conflates the language use of racialized bodies with linguistic deficiency. So even when racialized language users engage in linguistic practices that are situated as so-called normative, based on standard language ideologies, so that's to say when they quote unquote sound white, their language may still be perceived as deficient to the white listening subject. So back here in the Adair and colleagues, these Latinx students are probably, or you know, maybe talking or interacting in very similar ways to the white students, but they may have been perceived as not having as good language because of this conflation of racialized bodies with linguistic deficiency, which is, in my opinion, linguistic racism. So childhood is a cultural phenomenon, and child-rearing practices are not universal. And importantly, communication styles are not universal. And yet success is measured by assimilation to a certain set of practices, and these certain set of practices look like white linguistic hegemony. And so-called quality linguistic input is simply the discursive styles of a certain demographic, and it is a value judgment and not a characteristic of any human language or language variety. And so some takeaway messages. We do not know as much about language development as we'd like to know. The field has a race problem. Hearing babies do not need to be spoken to a certain way to develop language. One of the truths that we know about language development is that they will develop language spoken or sign, well, hearing babies, spoken language without direct teaching. The word gap is not real. It's an extrapolated number and it's racist. And there is no such thing as quality linguistic input, and suggest so is linguistic racism. Thank you.